Welcome, everybody. Mordechai Plaska here. Welcome to shareenjoyment.com. I found myself in Brooklyn tonight. I pulled over to the side of the road to give the share, so I hope that it's clear and that it comes through as I hopefully intended to come through. So there's four different topics I want to try to cover tonight. I gave a share this morning on all four, and it spans roughly 40 minutes, but we only have 10, so I wanted to try to keep it tight. The first topic is Jean Valjean. Sorry about that. So the first topic is Les Miserables' Jean Valjean. I don't know if anybody saw the Broadway show many years ago, but it brought to light the contrast between Les Mis' portrayal of a slave versus the Jewish way of dealing with such a similar event. So we all know that in the play, there was an individual named Jean Valjean, 24601, and he stole a loaf of bread, and as a result, he was imprisoned for several years. He tried to escape, and then his prison sentence was doubled. So he ended up serving roughly 15 years or so. And a brutal punishment, cruel and unusual. And even after his release, he was still relegated or designated as a thief. So despite the fact that he served his time, he nevertheless bore that stain on his name for eternity. So we contrast this approach to the Jewish way. Person is unable to afford a loaf of bread. He steals it. He gets caught, and he can't repay it, so he becomes a slave. Now, as a result of becoming a slave, the master has to give up his only pillow, if that's what he has in his house, to the slave. If the master only has one blanket, he has to give that up also to the slave. The mattress, much the same. So a slave that had nothing all of a sudden becomes entitled to everything. But it comes at a cost, right? What is the cost? The cost is being able to view inside a Jewish home. And so he sees the wife lights candles before Shabbos, infusing Ruchnius into the home. He sees and he hears the Zmiros and the Divrei Torah, and he enjoys the delicious food at the table. Again, inside the Jewish home. After 6 years, he's now able to go free, and he has a choice. Unlike others, he actually can choose his future. And so we hope that the sacrifice that this family had committed for the past couple years will be positively reflected in this individual who now can become a beacon of light onto others, positively influence other people in the same way that he was influenced. And if a certain circumstance were to arise in the future where there would be another Jewish slave, he would open up his doors and he would welcome that person in. And so this is the difference between the secular penal code and the Jewish one. In the secular world, a person goes into prison and learns from others about what they had done wrong and probably perfects the trade, because that's all he's surrounded by, which is negativity, angry. You know, people are angry and upset about the penal system. It's unfair. It's unjust. And there's no positive influences that are coming into this person's life. And we contrast that to the Jewish way. And so there's so much to be proud about. There's so much to be thankful that HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave us this opportunity. What happens, however, when a person decides that after 6 years he doesn't want to go free? Lo etzichoshi. He doesn't want to go free. So v'ratza d'naves ozno b'matzea. And so the master brings him to the doorpost and pierces his ear. As Rashi says, this was the same ear that heard Kabbalah Satorah. How is it that you can declare a human, a man of flesh and blood to be your master when Hashem is offering to be your master? And so therefore the ear that heard this and ignored it is pierced. That it should never forget it. Marzea, interestingly enough, is equal to 400. That's 400 years you were enslaved and now you still don't want to go free. What's wrong with you? So that's the punishment. And then Vavadol Le'olam, he becomes a slave because he just doesn't seem to have the functionality or the capability to become an independent beacon of light onto others. And that's exactly the messaging that we're trying to infuse over here. Parents sacrifice so much. Brand new cars. They could be driving Porsches and Lexuses and all these other fancy cars. Instead, they give it all up to send their kids to yeshiva. Well, maybe not everybody, but There are many people that would love to drive a nicer car, but they give it up so that their children can enjoy the benefits of yeshiva education. It doesn't come without a price. It doesn't come without sacrifice. And everyone knows everyone is sacrificing something. And we hope that as a result of all the sacrifice that we give to our children, that they will be able to understand and appreciate, and so that they themselves will be able to carry the torch forward. This is the first level example of what we're trying to infuse in the parsha, and really begins with a question. Part two of part one is, why of all the mitzvahs that the Torah could begin a parsha like Mishpatim, such as Shabbos, you can start talking about Shemitah, Yovel, the laws of Kiddushin, of marriage, even the laws of other topics related to Moed and other things of the holidays and Yom Tovim. Why talk about a topic such as this one, which is so uncomfortable? Ki signa evet ivri sheshenem tavor all of these topics, why are we talking about things that make us feel uncomfortable? Why not talk about something loftier? Why talk about... So the answer that Rabbi Yosef Karo, who raises this question, his uncle, and he offers the answer that we are worried about and concerned about, Hashem is worried and concerned about the weakest link in our society, which is the individual who doesn't have the confidence to go out and get a job. Now, it could be that he has confidence, but he's unable to find one. But at the same time, you know, we have Efes Kilo Yevcha Evyon. We have a mandate that we're not allowed to perpetuate poverty within our midst. Which means that we actually, as a nation, as a religious group, are always there with all of the Chesed organizations to help others in need. And so, therefore, there are so many opportunities for a person to accept donations. All they got to do is be willing to receive. And so the messaging over here in this part is that Hashem is worried about us individuals. He wants us to become independent, and we have to be confident. And sometimes it takes strength to be confident, but we have to learn how to be confident in the sense that we can carry our Mesoras HaTorah into the next generation. And I think that's the reason why, at least suggests the uncle of the Beis Yosef, Rabbi Yosef Karo's uncle, why we begin with this particular topic, Kisigna Evrid Ivri, because it could be very easy to ignore the weakest link, but in fact the weakest link is our strongest link, because if we think about, Sukkos, for example, the Aravos, are the weakest link on the four chambers, right? We have the Lulav, the Hadassim, the Esrog, and the Aravos. It's the Aravos that we're buying a second pair. It's the Aravos that we're separating and we're putting them aside in the refrigerator to keep them looking fresh, because they are the most brittle. They have no tam, no reach. They have no taste, no smell, which is symbolic, as the Medrash in Vayikra brings down. These are individuals in our midst that have no Torah, no mitzvahs, and so there's nothing that's really sustaining them. There's nothing that excites them. So it's very easy for them to become frail and brittle. And they are the ones that we are most concerned about. We look at them, our Ravos. How are they looking? Do we need to change them? How could we preserve them? Do we keep them in a basket full of water overnight? All of these questions come up. The Ramah would keep them, soak them in a bucket of water, ice water. It's amazing that they don't talk about how to preserve an Esrog or a Lulav or a Hadassim, but they're worried about the weakest link. And that's really something that Ravos also are, it's a broader discussion, but I don't have time for it. The second topic, if I could try to touch upon, so again, if you have to leave me, it's okay, but I have a few things I wanted to touch upon. Deferential fear. We see at the very tail end of Mishpatim that when Moshe Rabbeinu approached Har Sinai from a distance, not that song, don't worry, but he bowed down across from the mountain. Now, most of the time when you see a king, you bow down in front of the king. Imagine if you're in Brooklyn and you find out that the king is coming to visit, if we had one, or hundreds of years ago, if the king was coming to our village, we would bow down before the king even entered within a mile radius. Why would we do something like that? So Moshe Rabbeinu gives us this answer. V'shtachvisa mirachok. He bowed down from very far away. So explains the Kedushas Levi that there's Rachok and Karov. What's Rachok and what's Karov? Rachok is something that's distant from the mind because we're unable to digest We cannot imagine what the world looked like before it was created. We cannot imagine things that came into fruition. We cannot imagine what planets outside of our own Earth look like, because we're not, everyone is not an Elon Musk. We're not going to popularize, Mars and start building apartment buildings over there. But we don't really know what is lurking on the outside. And in fact, some things that are distant from us actually could be quite near. Going down a dark alley in the middle of the night, you might be concerned that there might be someone there who is dangerous to you physically, or it could be a giant rat. Who knows? So we don't do things like that because they frighten us. So whenever we're frightened of the unknown, it's the fear of the unknown, as they say, that's something we shy away from. However, this karov, karov are things that we're able to intellectually digest. We can see things. We can feel things. And as a result, we're able to appreciate them and draw ourselves closer. In a synonymous way, we also have the levels of ahava and yira. Yira, as we know, is the messaging of something that's rachok. We're distant in the sense that we have a certain level of fear, and yet ahava is something that we love. So something that's karov is something we can appreciate and draw close, and that's something we can draw ourselves even closer to in the level of ahava. So the analogy that I like to give is where, you know, you're waiting 20 minutes in Brooklyn, which I did recently for a parking spot, and I finally got one, and then the guy comes along and says, "That's my spot," and you have to move your car. So, of course, you know, the individual, not myself, would say, "Oh, well, you know, come on, let me just take the spot." But then the person takes out a weapon, he takes out a gun, and he says, "Please move your car." And then you turn and you say, "Well, now that you said please, of course I'll move my car." So there's this level of fear. So we all know that at Kabbalah Satara we had fear. Kafalim Harkagigas. Hashem took the mountain and put it above our heads. Right? Kafa is the language of kippa, which is why we wear a kippa, right? That's where the language comes from. Kippa is kafa. So what does that mean? Hashem said, you know, Imatamakama Satara Muta, if you accept the Torah, great. Bimlav, Shom Teker Baskam. If not, then there will be your destruction. Why there as opposed to here? Here is my destruction because the mountain's above my head. So why are you telling me, so this is the Beis Halevi's question, the Briska Rav's question, and the answer is that while you're experiencing the fear, you're going to do what's required of you. When the fear goes away, what's going to be left? Why would you continue to practice Judaism if you don't have that fear element? So therefore, in order to bridge the two, you have to have ahava. You have to love the Torah. You have to love the mitzvot. You have to appreciate these things. I just heard a beautiful thought that my friend Ramesha, I'm not sure if he's listening, he sent me a beautiful clip about Rabbi Freifeld and putting on tefillin, and while he put on his shel yad, he stopped and he started to smile, and then he continued to put on his tefillin, and one of the talmidim asked him, "Why were you smiling? Was it because you invested in GameStop, or did you do some short selling and make a few million dollars overnight?" "No," he said, "I remember the Gemara that Rav Zeira returned to Rav Yirmiyah, and he said, the reason why I'm smiling is because I put on tefillin today." I love that Gemara. It's just, there's no words to describe the simchas achayim that a person has by simply being able to do the mitzvahs of Hashem and to appreciate the fact that you're a Jew. You have an obligation to put on tefillin, and you love the fact that you can do that. That is beautiful, because it really brings to light, this is really what it's all about. It's a simchas achayim, the simple things in life. And you're able to put on tefillin, ashrecha, praise be to you. So, that's the level, that's the appreciation. So therefore the Torah tells us, on Vishtach HaVisim Rachok, the Pasuk says, Shalom LaRachok VeLaKarav Amar Hashem, that we have to be able to operate in two levels. Hashem says, I offer my peace, which is Shlemus, which is completeness, to the one who is Rachok VeLaKarav. We have to be able to operate in a distant and in a near way, in a Yira and in a Hava way, which is that as Moshe Rabbeinu practiced, Vishtachavisa, he bowed down, demonstrating ahava and something that is karov, meirachok, from very far away. So therefore, whenever we approach mitzvot, we have to do it with deference. And that's the reason why this particular second segment of the Dvar Torah focuses on deferential fear. The third topic, by the way, I'm moving really quickly. The third topic is the Ben Ish Chai's opening to Megillas Esther. I just want to give you the broad-based nakuda that he brings out, and I'll summarize it very short, very, very quick. It's roughly 15 pages, but I want to try to just hit the thesis statement. And that is that Mordechai and Haman were partners in Ahasuerus's army, and Mordechai was a warrior, and so was Haman. But after the spoils of the war were divvied up, Mordechai and Haman became wealthy people. But Haman, you know, wasted his money on frivolous things, but Mordechai did not. And so Haman came and begged Mordechai for a loan, and Mordechai granted him that loan. And as a result of granting him that loan, he was an eved. It's incredible to correlate this to Parshas Mishpatim, what we just said about being an eved. But here was Haman being an eved to Mordechai. And so we see that later on, when Haman raises individuals 100 zuz, it says that Mashakan eved kanarabo, whatever he did. So even though he arranged that he should be in control of the Jewish people, again, Mashakan eved kanarabo, that it really was owned by Mordechai. So therefore, later on, when Haman's, you know, family, his sons, his 10 sons, and he himself are vanquished, Ahasuerus gives over the base Haman to Esther, who then gives it over to Mordechai, the rightful owner. And so, therefore, it was no big deal for the king to rescind a presidential order, because it was made in Taos. It was made by mistake, meaning it wasn't Kedas Kedin, because Haman himself was not a free man, which is why he hated Mordechai so much. And Mordechai himself was encouraged by the fact that A, he owned Haman in a sense, and B, when the children would leave the Beis HaSefer, he asked three children three different questions, like Pesuk Li Pesukeich, which today we all say is common nomenclature of, hey, what's going on, what's up, how you doing, you know, that kind of like, you know, Bronx speak. But, you know, the first kid he asked, he said, Pesuk Li Pesukeich, like, tell me something about what you learned today. And whatever that child would answer was usually a nevuah. It was a prophecy that was yet to happen. So the first child said, Utsu Eitzav Vesufar, right? That there will be advice that will be given. Actually, that's the second child. Right? And then what's the end of the pasuk? Darbu Dava Vilo Yakum, that the person will speak, but nothing will come of it. So don't be worried. And the next child said, I forget exactly how the pasuk goes, because I don't have it in front of me. It's a pasuk in Yirmiyahu, that I will grow old. So again, another reference to Mordechai, Gamza Yavor, as they say in Hebrew, as they say in Israel. This too shall pass. So too will Corona. It also will pass, God willing. So, you know, whatever. So the third child, I forget now what the third child is, actually the first child. I told you the second and third psukim. But whatever it was, Mordechai was encouraged by this, and knowing, of course, that nothing bad will come to the Jewish people. So I think that there's a level of confidence that we have to instill in ourselves that, God willing, everything will be okay in the future. Now, the last, so to close out the Ben Ish Chai says that we, number one, I think really the close out is that Mordechai saw in Haman someone to loan money to, and Haman, you know, had a friend named Mordechai. So although they couldn't stand each other, they had a long-standing relationship. And I think it's incredible that Mordechai should be the one to literally buy Haman. And that in itself is tremendous. Okay, the last thing I want to just say is, and I'm closing out. Sorry if I'm 10 minutes over, but... we know that we just celebrated the month of Rosh Chodesh, which just came upon us, and I had given this year a while back about how we take the word, we ask for Osher V'Chavod. So a person who is an Osher, yeah, everybody's kind of even in the sense that we're all looking for respect and honor and some wealth. As my father, Vashon, used to say, whether you're rich or poor, it's always good to have money. So it was always like a little joke he would kibitz with me. But the idea is that when a person has a shiras and he makes people, you know, uncomfortable with it, then if he loses it or if he's contingent upon it, then it could very well be that the cupboard will go with it. But if a person is going to honor somebody irrespective of money, then even if the person has it or he doesn't have it, the person will always retain the cupboard. So then we take a look at the word osher, and we understand that there are many different ways a person can use the money. Number one, osher could be spelled ra'ash, which is osher is ayin shin resh, could be spelled resh ayin shin, ra'ash, which is hurricane. That time is money, there's no time for learning or tefillah or chasadim. It's just too much. There's no time for anything. The second level is Russia, that he takes the money and he uses it for negative influences into society. And the third level is Eres, which is a person who is like a cradle. He welcomes people in and he gives them etzos, gives them advice. And the fourth level is Sha'ar, a gateway, that he welcomes people in and he helps those people find new jobs. Or he helps that person get back on their feet. He gives them not just chizik, but he literally walks them in, gives them brachos, and he encourages this person to see the positive and to live a positive-filled life. And that there's something really majestic and beautiful about a message such as that, because as we know, this person is helping the other open windows of opportunity. Pitzchuli sharei tzedek avovamo deka. And that's really what we see in the word osher. We have five different combinations of that one word. And to close out this theme, we know that Adar, which is now we're on the, I believe, the third day of Adar. So we know that Adar is Rosh Tevos, Ani Hashem Rofecha, that Aleph Dalet Resh, Ani Hashem Rofecha. A person that has a court case, you should wait until Adar. A person has a presentation to make, to make new parnasa, he should wait till Adar to do it. And because Adar is an auspicious time, it's a time when in the Megillah we see that things turned out for the positive. And it's a chodesh that is replete with mazalos that are positive for the Jewish people. So therefore, in a similar vein, those that are not feeling so great, Adar, Ani Hashem Rafecha, hopefully Bez Hashem, they will start to feel better. Then the next month we all know is Nisan, which is a time of miracles. Nisan Nigal, Nisan Asin Nigal. In the month of Nisan, we were redeemed. In the month of Nisan, we will be redeemed. And so, therefore, there's positive, there's hope. And everything about what I'm saying tonight is all, you know, revolving around those two themes. And then the next month is Iyar, which is, again, Aleph Yud Yud Resh, Aleph Yud Yud Resh, Ani Hashem Rofecha. This is a very, very auspicious time of the year. And we usher in the month of Adar, which is Marvin B'Simcha. We should enhance our Simcha, and we can do that by giving to others, inspiring others, helping others, lifting others, and remaining positive and sharing that level of enthusiasm with our friends, with our family, with our spouse, with our children, with our parents, grandparents, and hopefully encourage them and see that Gamze Yavor, as they say, that things are going to start getting much better. Bezos Hashem. It's Mordechai Palatsko wishing you the very best, and thank you for listening to these 23 and a half minutes. And I give back the balance of my time to all the good senators from New York, New Jersey, and B'chol Makom Shehein. Have a great night, great week, and please stay in touch. All the very best. Take care.